Greetings, everyone. I hope you're enjoying your Sunday and ready for the next episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast. This episode, I'm introducing you to Mike Oppenheim, who is truly, truly a polymath. During our conversation, I was left wondering, what does this guy not do? He and I had a really incredible conversation, and he shares four miracles, four truly magical events in his life, and each one is oh so different. And once again, it left me saying, my God, there is so much going on in this world that is so mysterious and so interesting, and I just wish that everyone could understand that this place is a truly incredible world to live in. Now, Mike is many things, and he does talk about that in this podcast. He's an author, he's a top humor and philosophy writer on Substack, and he also was in two bands. He has his own podcast called Coffin Talk, which is about the meaning of death, and that one is actually in the top 3% on Apple Podcasts. He's so very interesting and such a great speaker. I kind of felt like I could barely keep up with him. I hope you enjoy this conversation because lately it's been one of my favorites. All right, here's the very next episode of the podcast and my conversation with Mike Oppenheim.
So I bought a helmet the next day and I started wearing it. And then 2 weeks from the day of the accident, I was leaving my house and it was the best weather ever. And I was like, screw it, I'm leaving the helmet at home. And I felt knowledge. This is the only way I can explain it. I don't hear voices. I feel knowledge. Like my intuition is never a voice. It's like knowledge. It's just like something hits me. And it said, I'm going to say it said, but like for the sake of the story, but it wasn't a saying. Like I'm not hearing a voice. What the hell is your problem? Get the hell back inside, get your helmet and put it on.
Who are you as a human being? If you had to go to a conference or a party and self-describe and say, hey, let me introduce myself. This is who I am. How would you do that?
I think that answer would have changed over the years and it just recently kind of re-centered itself. But I would just say I'm a humanist. I would say like I'm a humanist. And it means like most of what I'm doing now is the bottom line is how is this going to affect humanity positively? So while I am like a musician, a writer, a filmmaker, a father, a husband, and all these other roles, the more I like cultivate my spiritual outlook on life and my worldview, the more I see that like what we're doing is to me, the meaning and purpose of my life, which is just expanding connections and just trying to not leave Earth a better place than before, you know, because that's a little like egotistical to me, but just every interaction I have with another person is a chance to enhance and make their day better or a chance to make them feel lousy, you know. And so especially in the car, that's where I struggle with this the most.
I assume, you know, I was just, my sister and I walked over to this local grocery store and I'm outside Chicago and it was, people were just laying on their horns. And I've been living in New Mexico that we just don't have that kind of thing where people are just hands on the horn for like 5 to 10 seconds. And you can kind of feel the rage and the anger. And I thought, my sister said, well, you're in an urban environment. And I think, you know, urban environments are good, but I think they also make people a little grumpy, maybe a little crabby. So I think I agree. The car is a challenging place for sure for keeping your cool, you know, keeping cool around things. So, now you said that you're a filmmaker and you're a writer. And so what kind of filmmaking and writing do you do?
I think I probably should just go in order. Like as a little child, I was like very imaginative and I was really into music. So I got a guitar by the time I was like 11. I'd quit the piano and saxophone before that. But the guitar stuck because I worshipped like, you know, different musicians. And so I just made it my mission to start a band and start bands and become a professional musician. So I achieved that when I was 22 or 21. I graduated college and we started a professional rock band in New York. And my band and I we quit after a year and a half, and we quit for like a million reasons, but it was, in retrospect, we really should not have quit. Like, we were way ahead of schedule and we were doing great, but, it was still an incredible experience. And, from there, I went back kind of to like film, which was my other love in high school. So I was making films in high school, and in college, I was a film major. And then, suddenly like things really shifted, cause I quit playing music in my mid-20s, professionally. And, just cause I don't like staying up late at night. That's really essentially the problem with vowing to be a professional musician and having my personality. So I became a writer, cause that's like the perfect, I write, 5 a.m., 6 a.m. Like, I love the morning. So, and then I decided I wanted to get published and write novels. So I went to an MFA program, and I got an MFA, and I, my first novel was published, and then I self-published a few after that. And then I just had another one published. And it's actually interesting, because I say this to a lot of other writers. Self-publishing is actually more fun and better. Like, I would just recommend it strongly to people. I wouldn't even say self-publishing anymore. I think that's an anachronistic term, but, the point I'm just trying to make is I've done all these things. So now I got back into videos during COVID, because, my wife and I got married 3 weeks before the country closed down. We didn't know it was going to close down. We're just very lucky. Our wedding was on February 16th, 2020. And I remember people at the wedding saying, like, have you heard about this? They called it the Wuhan virus at the time. And so it was crazy, because our timing was really lucky. And then talk about a honeymoon. She was like pretty much unemployed collecting checks. And my job is like very, it's a work at home job always. So I've always telecommunicated. So I was like working a little bit. She was getting these checks in the mail, and then we were just making videos and having fun. So, my main thing I do though is writing, for sure. At this point, that's most of my income and what I'm spending more of my time on.
Just for my curious ears, what was the name of your band?
Oh yeah. The band that was most successful was called Punch Clock, like the thing you use to clock in and out. And it's because we all had really crappy blue collar jobs. And then we also had degrees from college. So we thought it was hilarious that our parents had told us you had to go to college, which is like, now I realize how generous and nice it is of parents to kind of force the kids, you know, or at least in the era I went, because it wasn't a huge fortune, but we thought it was like kind of ironic. So that was our band name. I don't think a lot of people got it though.
You sound like a bit of a polymath. Would I be wrong in assuming that?
Is that I know poly and I know math, but do you mean like literally like sciences and maths, or
no, someone who is interested in a lot of different things and likes to learn and become proficient at a lot of different.
Yeah. You threw me off with math just cause I'm good at math, but I have no training in it. Yes, 100%. And I definitely, I have been told many times in my career by professionals, who want to make money off of artists, that I have given myself the kiss of death by doing this, that I get really into things and I go into them and do them, and then I get bored and switch. So like, had I just stuck with one thing my whole life, I would be in a different spot. But like, I'm 42 and I have a family and I love my life and I love every second of my life. So while that was not true in my 30s, I had a lot of like imposter syndrome and issues and things. Now I'm very happy with the path I've cultivated. So
I love
it. And I learned a new word. Thank you.
Yeah. A new word. There you go. You are welcome, sir. You're welcome. Well, I'm so curious. Did you grow up in a religious household, or what did that look like for your family?
No religion whatsoever, but lots of spirituality. My parents are transcendental meditators, so they taught me how to meditate when I was a kid, which I thought was like dorky and lame. And like, I definitely stopped doing it from 13 to 20. And then, something kicked in when I was in, like, I think I was literally 12. I remember why. I mean, September 11th happened. So it was 2001, and I was freaking out. And my mom was like, have you tried meditating? And I was like, oh. You know, that actually sounds like it might hit the spot. And so I started meditating on September 13th, 2001, and I have literally never missed a day since. It's just like people take medicine. That's my medicine.
Can you describe what transcendental meditation looks like for just listeners?
Yeah, definitely. it was famous, really famous in the 60s and 70s, because this guy named Maharishi Mahesh Yogi came over from India and he taught the Beatles how to do it. And like, I mean, I could name, like, Jerry Seinfeld does it. All these celebrities love it. David Lynch, one of my favorite filmmakers. But I'm actually, I feel torn because there was like a weird arc with it where it became very expensive to learn it. But all of the money was going back to India to build houses and stuff for poor people. So it's not like this guy Maharishi was just sitting in a mansion. He really wasn't, like, you know, he died with grace and like honor. And there's no like tell-all memoir that says he was like a scumbag. However, with that said, I just prefer to do the meditation practice and just keep it simple in my life. And so the way I describe to people is there's many forms of meditation. The reason this is probably the easiest, especially for Westerners, is it's called effortless meditation, which means you have a mantra and you start with it. And then when it goes away and you remember or recall that it's gone away, you just go back to it. But there's no wrong or right. There's no judging it. They specifically go through all the forms of judgment you could have. And I'm not speaking judgment in like this, you know, modern metaphysical context that we use that word, like, you know, don't judge people. Like, it literally just the actual like definition of discerning or judging, because like the more stressful the meditation is often means the more stress you're releasing. So like, really weird emotions and feelings come up sometimes for people. I've actually, because I started so young, it's just smooth sailing for me. I just love it. I like transcend. And oh, that's where the word transcend comes from, is there's like liminality between the states of consciousness and unconsciousness, right? Like when you go to sleep, there's that weird moment where you like know you're falling asleep, or when you're waking up. Meditation takes you to a different point, but it's similar to that, which is between, like, according to the theory, like Maya is the grand illusion, this duality, but everything comes from one. And so transcendental meditation is supposed to take you from the duality into the consciousness of one. I can't prove or say that it does that, but I can tell you that the bubbling bliss feeling of transcending is unlike any drug I've taken, any alcohol high. It's pretty similar to like when you first fall in love. So, you know, I think there's something to that, but it's a unique process and I recommend it to everyone.
Yes, I had a functional nutritionist who suggested that I start TM when I, as part of my protocol, but it got to be really complicated for me. I had to get a teacher who I had to pay every month, and it just got like really, and it felt a little pyramid schemey for me.
Yes.
Really made me feel uncomfortable. And I thought, you know what? If I'm supposed to do this, I'll find some other way, because it just made me feel a little strange. Plus, I had to check in with this person who's a stranger, and I don't feel comfortable with that process either. I know that it has done wonders, and there's amazing scientific studies about, I'm sure you've heard of them, where they had a bunch of people do meditation and it lowered like crime rates in the area and changed kind of the valence just in the general area of like everything that was going on. So there is something to that collective kind of practice and just shifting and changing and having a really positive effect on reality. I totally 100% believe in that, but just, I was so bummed when it turned out to be this, you know, I was already going to her for some serious health issues. And then I had to like make myself vulnerable to someone I didn't know and pay all this extra money. And I just was like, I can't, this is just too much for me right now. But that doesn't mean it's like going to be like that forever. This person was going to give me my own personal mantra. I think that was also what I had to pay for.
That's so essentially, that's why I'm so reticent to like say I do transcendental meditation, TM, as you called it. And it's not that I lie about it or cover it up. And the only reason why is like, if you like your Apple phone, but you also know that Apple people are a cult, it's kind of hard to like explain to other people that like you can still use an Apple phone and not be in the Apple cult. And if you keep the two apart, now, as far as the learning goes, that's exactly what I was describing, is yes, there is a process to learn it. And yes, it is like bona fide, meaning the mantras are like sacred sounds that reverberate and work. With that said, I believe that you could say any word you want and do the practice and it would work. And I'm not going to go on record on the internet saying that, because I don't want to get like sued or deal with any flack from it. But I will say that I think, you know, this is a, even like nationalism, even just being a member of a country is like this for me. It's really hard to like, you know, and groups like, they trademark things. Like the West is full of like intellectual trademarks. That's a very peculiar notion. In India, you could never trademark meditation, or at least ancient India. So he, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, has explained, he's dead now, but he explained that he brought a gift to the West, but also knew that he was going to take the riches and money from the imperial West and rededicate it back to what you described, which is making established places for people to live and meditate 24/7. And the studies that you're talking about, there was one in famously in Washington, D.C. that they did for a week in the 70s, I believe. And then right now in Missouri, the state of Missouri paid the company to teach all the prisoners because the rehabilitation effects are incredible. So it's hard because I feel like I'm talking out of two sides of my mouth, but I'm really not. Transcendental meditation works. Apple iPhones are cool. There's Android. Android works. So it's like there's a million ways to do it. And one, what I would really recommend to people, though, is the effortless version doesn't frustrate you. And the other ones can and do, from what I hear. So I am pretty adamant about, like, why would you want to learn something that's strict when there's something, you know, that feels less strict? And then what the guy Maharishi always said, and I do agree, is he said, there's a million ways to get from America to London. You can take a boat, you can take a plane, you could, like, so he just said, like, this version of meditation is the fastest jet developed by consciousness, so that if you really want to get to the point of meditation, this is the one. So yeah, but I agree with everything you said. I my tons of compassion for how you described it, and that's pretty accurate.
Right now I'm doing meditation that's kind of I call it imaginal meditation. So I, you know, the person with the dulcet tones of their voice that I'm listening to takes me on an adventure, and I get to imagine every step. And I like that. It's fun. I'm having, and I never know what's going to happen. You know, it's always exciting and fun for me. And I always, whenever my mind drifts off, because it does all the time, people quit meditating because they're like, it's so hard and I can't.
Yeah.
I can't concentrate. I keep going off script, but that's what happens. That's the practice. So you just recenter back in and you say, you forgive yourself. Okay. All right. I just got a little lost there for a second, but what's going on right now? And you just recenter yourself. And I do believe, honestly, like, it's been amazing for my nervous system, for my vagus nerve, for everything, for just chilling me out, me out, which I've needed.
I love it. And that's well described. And I would stick with what you're doing. You know, just journaling, walking, all of these things are forms of meditation. But what you said is the key, which is you can't beat yourself up and you can't get frustrated just because you have an attention span and it does what it does, you know?
I know. I have noticed that, you know, it's like, oh, did I forget to do this? Did I forget to do this?
Yeah, yeah.
It just kind of creeps in and there's nothing I can do about it. But I was going to ask you, it sounds like your parents were sort of spiritual seekers. Would you describe that? Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yes. And what's weird, I told you I'm a writer. I actually really upset my mom recently, and then she was okay with it because I wrote an article, an essay about how my parents, like, were on the spiritual path, and then they just kind of went, yeah, like, you know. So my dad stayed on it much longer than my mom. They both still meditate and they're very dedicated to it, but their curiosity, I really shouldn't say they, it's really different between my mom and my dad. But anyway, the article I wrote was just about my mom, but then she reread it a week later and said, oh, it's full of love. And I understand what you were saying, but I do, I feel like this black sheep now, because I shunned spirituality as a kid. Cause I was a kid, you know, I was a teenager. I was like, no, I'm going to be a punk rocker. I'm going to smoke pot and, like, you know, screw this. And then my brother also wasn't doing it. And then we both came around to it. So it's interesting. Now my brother and I run this podcast I do, which you're going to be a guest on, called Coffin Talk. And it's a metaphysical podcast. It's about spirituality. And so it's very interesting. But yes, I would say that especially at the time of my birth in my early formative years, my parents were like, my mom was always like, say a prayer when you hear an ambulance, like, you know, just those kind of things. But there was no mention or reference to, like, technically my dad is Jewish and my mom converted, and we did, like, eating challah and, like, drinking wine on Fridays and stuff, but I never got bar mitzvah and we didn't go to temple, and I barely understood who Jesus was until, like, kids in high school were talking about it. Yeah.
I love that. I think it's so much more interesting to have questing parents because it just really, I don't know, illuminates a lot more of the world to children, to kids, to teenagers, when you have parents that are actively looking or searching for some way to connect or learn about a new secret of the universe or something like that. So I think that's kind of exciting. And, you know, a lot of the stories that people tell, I love that you brought up liminal spaces because they're everywhere. Yeah. And, you know, especially in myth and folktale and fairy tales, there's always these liminal spaces that, oops, someone accidentally walks into, and then where am I? What's happening? I don't know what's going on. But why is that person have green skin? So I love that because so many of the experiences on this podcast that my guests share with me have to do with a liminal space and either in finding oneself in it or accidentally stumbling into it or even dreaming about it. And it's really fascinating. I'd never considered that meditation can do that. And I do think it's really beautiful that you brought up Maya, right? The grand illusion. You know, it's a little bit of a depressing thought too.
Yeah.
Frankly, it's a little bit depressing, but it's also beautiful, you know, to consider. And then it begs the question, what are we all doing here? That's a even bigger question than this podcast can handle, but it is beautiful to think of. And I think is that from the Vedas, I think?
Yeah.
Sanskrit. Yeah, okay.
Which okay. is where transcendental meditation comes from. Transcendental meditation makes no effort to hide the source. The source of it is from the Vedic tradition, which is 12,000 years old. And they're very like, you know, proud of that. And so, you know, I guess in the beginning there was a sound. The Big Bang is the sound Om, according to East West. So it's very interesting that every quantum physicist was immediately going back to like the Vedas. You know, even Oppenheimer with the atomic bomb quoted the Bhagavad Gita. So, you know, it's this intersection of like their science and our science. And also I always bring this up just because it fascinates me. The Great Pyramid, like the very biggest first one, that was older to Cleopatra than the invention of the cell phone is to her. So like less time has elapsed between her death and now. And so all of this, just like, think about like science, huge air quotes for people listening, because we just think of science as like the scientific method, Newton, you know, and like this, like, but that's just a drop in this weird bucket. And yeah, so meditation is a science and it's Kriya Yoga. It's the yoga of the mind. And it's the most essential component of asanas, of the body yoga. So, you know, if you're a healthy practitioner in life, you're supposed to have a spiritual, a mental, and a body physical existence, and you're supposed to marry all three. And so meditation is essential. And just real quick, because it was so pertinent. Oh, no, I forgot it. Never mind. There was something else we were talking about that was about.
Are you sure? Because I do a lot of editing here. So if you think about it, let me know. I was talking about liminal spaces.
Yeah.
Talking about Maya and let's see, the Vedas. I mean, I find the Vedas to be completely fabulous and mysterious. And what I was going to say was I just read an article recently where the author referenced quantum theory and atoms. And they said, well, I mean, but in the Vedas from I don't know how many thousands of years ago, someone was already writing about how everything was energy and little points of energy and that kind of stuff. And I yeah. thought, good Lord, we are so late to this party. Yeah.
That's what, you know, it's funny because I'm not one of those like the East is better than the West people. I think that's a ludicrous accusation. And I think there's also the North and the South, the East and the West. You know, there's just a lot of pocket cultures. But I will say the arrogance of our paradigm of being an American and this, like, you know, even not to get political at all, but just watching us deal with COVID was like air quotes hilarious. I mean, it was just like, no matter what opinion you have to see the humor in like so many people using the word science to argue against someone else's science. So I agree with that. And I did remember what I was going to say, which is the most life-changing, mind-blowing thought that was ever introduced to me that still to this day helps me cope with the depression of the grand illusion is that where do you go when you dream? Like, you're there and you're here. So clearly when you die or whenever whatever happens is, there's obviously something else that you already go to all the time. And your experiential time here feels longer than the dream, but there are famous case studies of people who have 7-year-long dreams. And like, you've probably experienced one yourself where like, you know, yeah, because you don't, your memory of the dream is different from your experience in the dream. But anyway, all of this just gets into what is consciousness? Is it coming from our brain or is it beyond the brain? You know, all this stuff is just my favorite topic ever. So,
wait, I'm sorry. What do you mean 7-year-long dream?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the, in a dream, you have an experience of time in the dream. But like, if you actually monitor a person who's sleeping, they're having like REM patterns of sleep for like maybe 2 minutes, but then that person will report, you know, details of a dream that lasts longer than 2 minutes. And so there are people who have reported that they were stuck in a dream. I forget the word for it. And they could not get out. And it was 7 years. They had a 7-year, like calendars were moving and like, and they did not, they don't say they hated it or liked it, but they say they were trapped. They for sure knew that there was a person dreaming and that they're more into that person than this person, but then they had to give it up and just admit that they were here now. So I always wonder, like, you know, who's dreaming who here? Like you or me? Is this a dream? Is that a dream? Which is the real state? How do we know that this isn't the fun, crazy, zany adventure and then this ends and you go back to some other greater or even worse existence?
I love that. I've certainly had dreams. You know, I dream a lot. I'm a big dreamer. And I've had very precious dreams where with my body and soul, I knew I was somewhere else. I could feel it. I was 100% somewhere else. And I've talked about one of them recently where I was on a planet that was not Earth. And I was in the ocean and I was swimming near the beach. And I could see when I looked up another planet really close by. And I was in the water and swimming. And all of a sudden, I found myself drifting out further and further and I couldn't get back to shore. And then suddenly this dolphin came up to me and led me back to shore. And, you know, but the feeling in my body was so visceral well, first of all, it felt like where I was home. Like I had a deep sense of knowing that I was home wherever I was on this planet that wasn't Earth. But you know, there was also the feeling of being scared because I was being drawn out into waters that were uncomfortable to me and I couldn't get back. But then this dolphin, I mean, you could read so much into this dream.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So much. But the most fabulous part of the dream, which was really fascinating, is, you know, I looked up and I saw this other planet and on that, there was a, what do they call those bridges that they want to build from Earth to the moon? Not a sky bridge, some sort of bridge that would connect us to the moon. So you wouldn't have to, you could just get on a like a conveyor and go out to the moon if you wanted to. There was one of those up to this planet and I could see spaceships up there and people getting on and off. And I thought, what is going on? But there was such a deep feeling of ease and comfort and finally being home that when I woke up, I missed that place. It yeah. felt like I had left the true place where I was supposed to be. And I was kind of heartsick. And I thought, oh my gosh, I got a glimpse of something that is so profound. And now I have to live with that glimpse, knowing that there's this other place. I don't know. Dreams can be completely fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah. I got so many goosebumps as you told that. And it's just, I swear, like it's just, we spend so much time, I think, convincing ourselves that this is it. I think we prefer that because it's scary to think I don't know everything. I'm not going to know everything. And as you said, like, I feel this is someone else's term, but like this meat suit is clunky. Like, I feel like I should be able to fly. Like I really do. Like I always just intuitively felt like I'm limited physically in a way that doesn't feel right. And I love swimming because I think when we swim, we like feel this motion that we like should be able to do in the air or something. I don't know, but your dream touched so many tangential like spots in my, yeah, like, I mean, that was incredible.
Well,
I do not dream
fun.
Like that, by the way.
You what?
I don't have dreams like that. I'm jealous.
Well, cool. I do, you know, when I was a kid, I certainly had dreams of flying, but, and sometimes it was easier than others. And I also remember waking up then and thinking, okay, this is poopy that I can't just fly in general in the world anyway. Like it doesn't make any yeah. sense. And it should be that we could all fly. I mean, I think that, I mean, yeah, there would need to be some sort of air police to make sure we don't crash into each other. But in general, I think it would be a grand adventure. And I hate heights, so I don't even know what I'm talking about. I would maybe go like 10 or 20 feet off the ground. I'm totally too cowardly to go any higher than that. So yeah, I don't know how people with vertigo would do with that. Probably not very well. I would love for you to just tell me, I don't know how, let's see, knowledgeable you are about the Vedas or what have you, but what are some of your favorite takeaways from the Vedas that you have kind of?
I'm by no means an expert, but I am like a huge fan of what they call like, I mean, just a lot of the theories, like the Akashic Record theory, which is this idea that, I think paramount to this discussion would be, if you think that time is a real variable that is fixed, none of this can make sense and won't make sense. And it sounds preposterous. If you put yourself in your fake Einstein shoes and you pretend you're like half as intelligent as that guy was, time is a variable. And he made it very clear to all of us. Like, there's my favorite example is 1 minute with your hand in like a cool, like water is very different than a minute on a stove, you know, and 1 minute in the comfort of someone you love is very different from 1 minute with a person you can't stand. So like time really is relative. And when you start to understand that, you could see that while it feels like there's causality to the universe, there's absolutely none. It's just us stringing it together. So I think what the Vedas to me helped me see is that they talk about the cycles of destroying and creation and destroying and creation, and it's endless. And that kind of relates to like this big pyramid thing. Like, where did that culture go? They're dead. Like, modern Egyptians are not those Egyptians. There's no connection whatsoever. They don't even think they're genetically the same. Like, nothing makes sense with the history of Earth. And especially as we uncover new geological, buildings that prove that civilization is older than we wanted to say it was to fit like this explanation. So with all that said, I just think it's crucial to understand that like you were born and you got older and bigger and then you got normal and then you start to get smaller and you're gonna die. Like, and that you're gonna die part we whisper in the West. But in the Vedas, you wouldn't look at it as a whispering event, because what you just talked about, that place that felt like home, that is home. And you totally do want to go back there. And so like you don't want to leave people you love here, but you certainly don't want to stay here forever. And I think I just talked about this with someone else, but like we go to funerals because we're sad, because we lament the loss of a person we liked. The person who died is probably like, oh yeah, I feel bad and I loved all you people, but like, check it out. I'm over here in Two Planet World and everything feels safe and I'm swimming with dolphins, you know? So like, that's why heaven is such a great carrot rope, I think, in our culture, is that it's just a simplified version of what we're talking about.
That I definitely can be led by a carrot anywhere, so
yeah, me too.
Two thumbs up for that. And it's healthy and it's good for you and lots of fiber, which we all need more fiber. So thank you for that. And I do think, you know, these are all such big ideas and big topics, and you know, the Vedas are massive. Okay. It's not like it's some like tiny little book that you can carry around with you. It's like thousands of years of discerning and interpreting and trying to comprehend what's going on in this reality or our relationship to it. And its relationship with us, you know, because it's also, it has a relationship with us. And I think that's important to understand. You know, I always tell people on this podcast that, hey, to really be invested in this reality, understand that you're co-creating, so that when you speak to that energy or that, however you want to call it, God, the Great Spirit, your ancestors, what have you, that if you start a conversation, that energy will talk back to you in some way, and you can make it co-creative and you can start working together. And I really do think those energies, that energy, that's what they're looking for from all of us, is to understand that, hey, we're co-creating everything with you, but we want to have a more conscious conversation where you're invested, we're invested, what have you. I'm sure they're looking down at me right now and they're saying, don't speak for us. Do not speak for us. But this is just with my little tiny brain, how I discern what's going on in this world. But yeah, thank you for that, because I think you're my first guest who's brought up the Vedas. So I appreciate it very much. Cool. And it just reminds me, I need to read in more about that. Find some books or something to read about the Vedas again and Sanskrit. And just, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous lineage of knowledge that I think most people don't pay attention to these days. But every time I read something about it, I think, how did I not know this for so long? Like, this is knowledge that I need. Well, you know, the central idea and concept of this podcast is I ask every guest, please, I would love to hear a story or stories where you feel like you've witnessed or experienced something magical or miraculous in your life. And it could have happened to you. You could have witnessed it. I mean, it doesn't have to be just one. I'd like to hear whatever you want to share.
Yeah, I have a lot, actually. So I think I'll go in order. I think there's probably four. And they range from super funny, interesting, and cool to very tragic, and people are gonna like feel sad, but I don't care because I'm an open book and that's my life. Also, interestingly enough, all of the events I'm about to disclose are 9 years apart, which I just find interesting. So the first one is the first time I thought something magical or weird was going on. I went to college and I was a freshman, and it didn't take for me. I flew 3,000 miles away from home to a place I'd never visited, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I went there for a million reasons that were good. But within about a month, I realized I'm a weirdo from California. I don't fit in. I have no friends. I had the best group of friends ever in California. They're all still hanging out. They went to colleges near each other. I made a huge mistake. But I made a huge mistake that I couldn't go back on. You know, tuition's been paid. I'm there. I have a place. I also bragged to everyone that I'm cool and I'm flying 3,000 miles to a place I haven't seen. You know, so I started praying for an excuse to leave without realizing I was praying. That's a very important part of the story. But I know in retrospect that thoughts are prayers. So I was thinking, anyway, one day I felt really sick when I woke up and I couldn't eat. And a week later, I still couldn't eat. And I passed out in the middle of a class in the hall. And I woke up with paramedics over me and they took me to a hospital. And after a litany of tests that took 5 hours, a doctor walked in a room with no smile on his face and said, Mike, you have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and it seems pretty late stage. You need to deal with this. You could potentially die. And so they told me, they released me for this. Is the story's weird. I was 18. So they're like, they just released me with that news. And so I went home and I'm like crying. And I called my best friend back home, this girl who I would go on to date later. And I cried to her and told her what happened. She's like, well, what did your parents say? And I'm not telling my parents. And she's like, what, why? And I'm like, oh, I'm just not. She's like, okay, well, at least tell your brother. So I was like, all right, I'll tell my brother. So I called my brother and I said, you have to promise not to tell mom and dad. And I told him, and then I hung up, and then the phone rang a minute later and it was my parents. My brother had told them. So anyway, they were about to withdraw me from school and fly me back to San Francisco for like cancer and stuff. And then this is why I believe in magic. I didn't want to go. In the period of my mom flying out to like take care of me and all this crap, I made two really good friends and I suddenly loved Pittsburgh. So after I go back for screening in a week and it's the same, not worse, like the white cell, red cell counts. And then I go back a week after that and the count's the same. And then the count was like slightly better. So I was like improving a little bit. So they said, okay, you definitely aren't in stage 5 or whatever. You're in whatever this is. So my mom's like, all right, I'm going to fly home and then we're going to wait for the next test and then we'll figure out whether to withdraw you and all that. And then I went in for the next test and it was gone, completely gone. And the doctor told me sometimes things go in remission. You should like follow back. And so I told my mom and she said, all right, well, tell us how the follow-up goes. So I lied. This is the weird part of my personality. I lied to everyone. I said I went to a follow-back and I never did. And this was when I was 18 and I'm now 42. So there's no way I'm carrying non-Hodgkin's. I've also, as we'll learn from these next stories, I've been medically tested a couple times since then. So I definitely don't have it. So that made me believe in much more than the positivity of prayer. It made me believe in the negativity of prayer. This was a lesson for me in like, be careful what you wish for. Don't ask. Well, the next story is another example. So when I was 26 and a half, So remember, I was 18 when the first thing happened. And then I was turning 27. I can't remember the exact details, but I had decided, and actually I just wrote a series of essays on this. So if people want to check it out, you can go to my website and read this. There's like a full, it's a long story. I will make it much shorter right now. I had made plans to go to a graduate program and I was going to get a law degree because I was giving up on myself and my dreams of becoming a writer and a musician. And so I committed to the University of Oregon to get a concurrent degree in law and conflict resolution. I was going to be a mediator and help homeless people and prison convicts. That was like what I was going to do. But as like the summer started to like approach and it was getting closer and closer to moving and going to the program, I realized I made a horrible mistake. I didn't want to do it. I loved Portland. I loved my friends. And also, bing, 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 I just knew I didn't want to be a lawyer. I knew that like that was an easy path in life for my personality and where I'm from. Like that's like a not, it's a beaten path. And whether or not, you know, and I'm not really financially driven as a human. I'm just, that's never been my thing. So anyway, I started like praying for an out. Now at the same time, I was really into bicycling. I was like bicycling every day of the week. I would only drive one day a week. I like really, cause Portland, Oregon was like the first bike friendly city in America. Probably I'm not positive on this, but anyway, so one day I was bicycling, at night back from the bars with my friends and I never wore a helmet. And I saw a person not wearing a helmet, slam on the brakes, crash into a car, break their head into the back windshield, fall on the ground right in front of me. I walked up and I tried to help them as they bled out and I'm assuming they died. There's a chance they didn't, but I would be blown away if they didn't survive with like massive head trauma. I mean, no matter what, this person's life changed that day and it probably ended. My friend at the time, she's still a friend, but she elbowed me really hard and was like, do you see why you need to wear an effing helmet? Cause you know, my friends were like, you're so arrogant. Like, why are you doing this? I was like, I like the wind. And I'm not a cool person. I cannot stress this enough to people. I'm not like this, like, leather jacket, chain smoking person. I just literally loved the feeling of wind. Like, I'm that stupid. Okay. So it wasn't a, like, try to be cool thing. It was literally, oh, then biking won't be fun. Helmets like make your skin weird. And, you know, it's just, so I bought a helmet the next day and I started wearing it. And then 2 weeks from the day of the accident, I was leaving my house and it was the best weather ever. And I was like, screw it. I'm leaving the helmet at home. And I felt knowledge. This is the only way I can explain it. I don't hear voices. I feel knowledge. Like my intuition is never a voice. It's like knowledge. It's just like something hits me. And it said, I'm going to say it said, but like for the sake of the story, but it wasn't a saying, like, I'm not hearing a voice. What the hell is your problem? Get the hell back inside, get your helmet and put it on. So I go all the way back to my house. I was like a block away. I get the helmet. I put it on. I go out and have breakfast with my friends. And then I'm biking home and I was lazy. So I put the helmet on over my sunglasses on my head. And then the same voice told me, if you get hit, that will cause the sunglasses to cave into your head and it will defeat the entire point of wearing a helmet. Stop, take the stupid sunglasses off and put them. So I did that. And then a block later, a car ran a stop sign and hit me. And were I not wearing a helmet, I 100% would have died. I smacked it like 3 times on the car and the pavement. I was in a wheelchair. And guess what happened when I was in a wheelchair? I didn't have to go to the law school program. They gave me my money back and they told me I didn't have to go. And then in that period, I realized I wanted to be a writer. So I applied for an MFA and I moved and went to Oakland, which is where I'm from. And my whole life changed. So that's the second story. The third one is a huge bummer and I'm gonna tell it, but I'm like reluctant because it's just a bummer and I still live with it to this day. When I was 31, I don't know, I was 30 or 31, I got married. And when I was 34, I had my first child, a son. And then we moved his mother, who's now my ex-wife, and I to Arizona, where I currently live, Phoenix. And we moved here to be closer to my parents to get like help because we were fighting a lot, especially about like taking care of a kid and finances. Oh, and I was in the Bay Area, which, as you know, is like just the most expensive place. New York City, Bay Area, LA, same thing. But anyway, so we moved to Arizona, but we continued to fight. And so we finally got a divorce. The divorce was really amicable despite like us not getting along, and we agreed to like a very fair custody, half and half pretty much, because my life was about my son at that point, and I mean, I just love being a parent. And so anyway, the only thing she fought with me, because we didn't go to court. We just came up with an agreement with two attorneys. The only thing she fought me for, and she threatened to go to court over, was that I had to give full rights to visit her parents, because she's a U.S. citizen, but she is from Thailand. So she was born in the United States with two Thai parents getting master's degrees. And I knew their family very well. We'd lived in Thailand on and off. I've lived there for a couple, we would stay for 3 to 6 months and then we'd come back to America. We would do this. So I didn't want to let her go, because I, that same knowledge based thing in me was there's something fishy about this. This doesn't sound right. But my lawyer just looked at me and was like, if you don't agree to this and you go to court, you're going to look what everything she's going to accuse you of. You're going to look like a controlling, husband who dominates his family and blah, blah, blah. What kind of dad wouldn't let his son visit their relatives in Thailand, So I reluctantly agreed to it. And then I decided to be generous. And so for her birthday a few months later, I gave her an earlier trip to Thailand. I said, you know what? You can go this year instead of waiting till he's three. So she left. I drove her to the airport, him and her. I packed the bags. I helped them with everything. They got on the plane and she never came back. She abducted my son. And here's the weird part of the story. After she went to Thailand, she was FaceTiming me and calling me every day. And so I took a trip to Ecuador. And I went to Ecuador because it was the only time I was going to have free time to travel, because my son wasn't in the country. And so while I was there, I partook in what's very popular now, which is plant medicine, ayahuasca. And I'm not an ayahuasca junkie. I don't swear by it, nor do I swear against it. But my experience was surreal, because on the third night I did it 3 times in 5 days there. With absolute certainty, I was told, same message system, you agreed before this life to not raise your son in his formative years. You're going against your agreement. We've tried to make this easy for you. We gave you a lot of outs, but you keep blocking it. You need to let him go. And the sooner you let him go, the sooner he'll return to you. He wants to have the experience of not having a father, and he wants to have the experience of hating his father. And you agreed to this. And I was again, I'm not a religious person. I don't believe in reincarnation, really. I don't believe in linearity, but I do somehow believe that I picked Mike. There's a me that is bigger and different than Mike. Maybe bigger is the wrong word. And Mike is a vehicle that this soul of mine is wearing for a time. And Tyler, my son, is a vehicle, blah, blah, blah. And so two entities, the same way you might agree to play the villain in a play, and then someone else agrees to be, it's and that's what the drama on earth is, according to this theory. But anyway, whether my theory is right or wrong, I came home and I told my dad, and he said, wow, that's profound. That's really insane. And then 2 days later, she cut off all calls and lied about the return trip home. So my dad can verify, who's not he's pretty skeptical and, reasonable, that I had this premonition, like it or not. But yeah, the bottom line is, whether or not I like it or not, the universe did prepare me for it. It did give me a valid reason and excuse that makes sense. And it also promised everything works out. He comes back. He's at your deathbed. He loves you. So, what am I supposed to say? Sometimes you go through a really bad period, but then when you come out of it, you're very thankful for it. And so I met my soulmate. I'm married. You saw her. She handed me coffee. And we have 2 children together. And I love my son. I have 3 children. I don't have 2. I don't speak and when people ask, I lie because I think it's polite. And also I think it's easier. And I just say he lives with his mom in Thailand, So I tell the story if it's applicable to a situation, but nothing bums someone out more than hearing about a father who actually loves the hell out of his child and can't see him.
So sorry. That is such a, okay. I mean, yeah. It's not, it is, you went at the beginning, you said, I have 4 stories and you said one of them are so is a bummer. And I'm going to guess it was this 3rd story. And I'm so sorry about all this. And I can't even imagine.
Yeah. It's okay though. Cause I think I do telling the story only for one reason, which is, I want to give hope to other people, because I have since found out there's a lot of, men can abduct children and women can do it. So I'm only speaking just because I happen to be a man, but there's a lot of dads out there who've had what happened to me happen. And I've actually met several children who told me, no matter what, I got curious. I wanted to know about this evil person my mom or dad kept telling me about. And I ended up touching base with them. And sometimes they ended up being as bad as the mom or dad had said, but very often they didn't. And then they had a great adult relationship with them. So I only pray that, like, whatever misinformation they're giving my son isn't so detrimental that he flips on them, because I don't hate these people. You know, I was very angry with my ex-father-in-law, ex-mother-in-law, and ex-wife for 3 to 4 years, but I just worked almost night and day on that. I did get over the hump. And so I also think there's a great lesson in that, which is, like, actually, I will make this political only because it's so sad to watch everyone in our country just hating the other side, like this red-blue thing. Work on your anger. Stop working on getting people to vote the way you want. Just, like, you shouldn't be angry when people disagree that much with you. It's okay to disagree, but there's something off when you're angry. When you're angry. So again, I'm not getting political about it, but anger management is, I think, the issue of all issues that all earthlings need to be working on. I think, like, schools should be teaching anger management in, like, first grade. Like, that should be, like, a period every day. Just, like, you know, I'm trying to teach my daughter right now. Like, they taught her this, like, blow on hot cocoa thing, you know, so she's freaking out and throwing her arms. And, like, it's hard to watch a child who can't contain their rage, because you know that feeling. Like, obviously, it's really hard. It goes back to the car thing, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that would actually be brilliant. I actually had a guest on here recently who invented this six-sided die. Of course, it has six sides. Anyway, it's for schools. And so at the beginning, one of the kids will throw it, and whatever side it lands on, that's the practice that they practice that day. So whether it's, you know, complimenting someone in the class, or giving them, like, a gift, maybe you find a flower outside, or you help them with an assignment or something. It's meant to engender compassion, empathy, and kindness, you know, and in the classroom. And I do think, yes, getting them young is key.
yeah.
And then I think you said you had a fourth one. Is that?
There definitely is, but it's not really an incident. It's more that since that experience with my son and ayahuasca, I met someone who teaches classes on how to get better at intuition. And I have since become, like, almost entirely reliant on it. I was actually earlier going to tell you that you made a joke, and I make the same joke. You said my tiny brain. That's true. Like, our tiny brains can't understand anything, basically. But the intuition understands everything. And so it's, like, weird to get used to. This actually ties into what we're talking about, which is we socialize children to say there's no such things as ghosts. There's no such thing as energy. There's no such. And then, like, in your mid-20s, you kind of start to be like, well, no, that person does have weird energy. I don't want to be in the bar next to that person. Like, and no, like, I do have a funny feeling about this. And I do want to pursue this weird option that isn't, like, sane, you know, like I've been offered this job with, like, this perfect thing, but, like, I just see this other thing. And you hear so much about people who regret not making intuitive choices. And you hear, like, less about the people who are proud they did, because you don't want to share it with people. You're embarrassed. You don't want to tell people you heard a voice or that, you know? So I think if you grew up in, like, a South American tribe that valued intuition and said the intellect is stupid, you might have a similar knee-jerk reaction to that, though, you know, like, well, you know, so there's definitely a balance, but yeah. So the fourth, like, magical experience for me has just been, like, learning to go left when my intellectual brain says right, because my intuition says left. Because had I listened to my intuition, I would have divorced my wife 6 months into our marriage. She blew up at me in a hotel. It was absurd. It didn't make sense. And it was the beginning of a lengthy 2.5 year process of just, again, anger, just her unbelievable anger to me. And, but it's hard because I don't regret having my son. So it's not that I, you know, but definitely intuition was, like, stepping in and saying, hey, buddy. And for all I know, my son still would have been my son, because we don't know how these things work, you know? So I, you know. But yeah, so that's kind of the fourth, is, like, now that I go back and look at how many intuitive moments I did or didn't listen to, like, going to Pittsburgh was intuitive. That was a correct decision. I'm still best friends with, like, 6 people I met there, you know? So, and also I got what I wanted. I got this blue collar experience coming from, like, the West Coast and a very, like, atheistic Bay Area, materialistic, you know? So
I do think, I mean, obviously I adore everything you just said about intuition, because it's this latent superpower that we have. And, you know, I remember being, I don't know, in my 20s, I suppose, 30s in Portland. I lived in Portland as well, Oregon,
oh, cool.
for about 20 plus years.
Oh, and, love it.
I remember going to New Renaissance Bookstore, I'm sure you on 23rd, and yeah, totally. Looking in the section for how to grow your intuition, how to listen to that still, silent voice. And I just, at that time, didn't believe into any of this crap, but I'd had some experiences that I thought, okay, there's something weird is going on. I want to get, because my scientific analytical brain wants to parse it out and kind of dissect it. So I was looking at all these books. I just remember sitting there looking at these books and thinking, why am I spending this money? Like, there has to be a better way of accessing this quote unquote intuition thing. But I think if the desire is there, it can help wake that up. Wake that trait that we have inside of us all up, because I've certainly had the experience. I was working at Manzanita Nehalem one summer.
Oh my God, it's one of my favorite places ever. Oh yeah, I love that.
Fabulous. And I was working at this wine bar, which is no longer there now. And this gentleman came in like about 8:30, and we closed at 9 at night. And he sat at the bar, and I just remember being terrified of him for no reason. He scared the crap out of me. And I just kept praying that everyone who was sitting there at the bar wouldn't leave me alone with him, because I knew something so bad could potentially happen. I didn't even know him. I'd never seen him before, but there was just something there that was so profound. And so now I think I refer to it as a superpower, and everyone has it. Everyone has it.
Yeah.
Just how much do you choose to actually ignore it to make your life more comfortable? You know what I mean?
Totally. So, yeah.
It's a superpower.
Yeah, no, it really is. It truly is. And it's there's a famous stand-up comedian, I can't remember which one, but I've heard him on numerous podcasts telling the story. But his mom went on a date, and the guy was like handsome, really good at talking, and just seemed to be the real deal. But she had a funny feeling, so she said no thanks when he offered her a ride home. 3 weeks later, that man was arrested in Colorado. His name is Ted Bundy. You know, and that's her story. And it's verified. Like, she had like numerous people, you know, so, cause he was a charmer, and apparently he was just, yeah.
So everyone, get in touch with your superpower, cause who knows how to change the world, you know, who knows? I hope you enjoyed this very next episode of the podcast and my interview with Mike Oppenheim. There will be a link to his Substack in the episode show notes. I need to thank Mike for taking the time to be a guest on the show and for telling all of his stories. Thanks to everyone who listens. I'm so grateful to all of you. And I need to thank all of you for the ratings and reviews you've given me. You have no idea how much those help other people find the podcast. And don't forget about the new YouTube channel. There will be a link in the episode show notes so you can check that out and subscribe to the videos and see my guests in real life. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Mike. Be into the mystery. Mike has lived this charmed life, it seems, and has this ability to walk through the world having all sorts of synchronicities and magical things happen around him. Be open to the mystery like Mike. Be aware that there is mystery in the world like Mike. And I bet so very soon, magical and miraculous things will start happening to you. I'll see you next week for the very next episode of the podcast. And until then, I hope life is filled with laughter, with dear friends, and with summer days and summer fun that just goes on and on and on.